On a Monday, we're getting up to speed on developments inside the halls of the state capitol. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So as we often do, let's take developments one at a time, starting with the confirmation process of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson, or I should say Secretary Designee. A Senate committee voted unanimously Thursday to send his appointment to the full Senate. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' cabinet picks not being confirmed, considering that secretaries can still run their agencies without being confirmed? Do you think it's political? And what do you think about the lieutenant governor saying he did not actually graduate college, although he indicated that he had in previous interviews? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Patrick Marley is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So Governor Evers picked to head the Transportation Department. Where does this confirmation stand with Craig Thompson?
So as you mentioned, he got through the Senate committee unanimously. Now the final step would be to go to the floor of the state Senate and get a vote there. But it's not clear that there's going to be a vote scheduled. The Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald just says that he and his colleagues are going to review all the appointments. None of Evers' cabinet has been confirmed, and decide who to take up and when to do that. So it's possible that they'll just take no action on Craig Thompson and possibly other members of the cabinet.
Do you see lawmakers making this a priority at all?
Well, they haven't so far. I mean, yeah, Evers has been in office for more than 7 months now, and they haven't confirmed him. You know, when Governor Walker first came in, they confirmed his cabinet pretty rapidly. Of course, they were all of the same party. So they seem to be slow walking this. They've given no indication what their timeline is. I do think they will take up some of these confirmations this fall, but there are some members of the cabinet who are not popular with the Republican senators, and Craig Thompson is near the top of that list, so it's really unclear what's going to happen with him.
Well, some Republicans have raised concerns over his past lobbyist role. Can you tell us more about his past that might inform what we're hearing now?
Yeah, so Craig Thompson was previously the head of a group called the Transportation Development Association. It's essentially a trade group that consists of contractors, engineering consulting firms, local governments, highway commissioners, anybody who really has a hand in the transportation system. And that group led the charge in recent years to make the case that more money was needed for transportation. And so, in 2018 and before that, they were saying that the gas tax needed to be raised or fees needed to be raised. Some new source of revenue had to be coming into the system. And they were really pretty, I don't think that they were committed to a particular stream of revenue. They just said they wanted more money, whether it came from tolling or gas taxes or fees. They were a little ambivalent about. Road funding became a big issue in the last governor's race, mm-hmm. and Republicans saw the Transportation Development Association's talk about this as effectively campaigning for Tony Evers. They said they weren't. They'd support any candidate who anybody who had a plan to pay for roads. So there's some residual distrust among Republicans that Craig Thompson was effectively campaigning for Tony Evers during the campaign.
Well, these secretary designees are still able to run their agencies without being confirmed. So does this really matter?
Well, that is a fair point. I mean, it's not as if, there's certain actions they can't take. Without confirmation, you can do everything that the confirmed secretary can do. There's just more protection if you're confirmed, because once you're confirmed, there's really it'd be very difficult for a cabinet secretary to get dislodged by anybody but the governor. When you're not confirmed, let's say something happens that's controversial and Republican senators decide that they need to hold somebody accountable, they could bring up his vote and vote to reject him, and he would be immediately out of his job. So there's, you're always kind of hanging by a thread if you're a secretary who is not confirmed.
We're moving through the State Capitol Report with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel politics reporter Patrick Marley as our guide. Are you following the lame duck lawsuits over voter ID and early voting laws and constitutional issues? Should these laws passed in December be challenged? What about gun legislation? Do you think Wisconsin should put more gun laws on the books following the recent string of mass shootings? Or do you think our state law is adequate? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick, it came out last week that Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes did not actually graduate college in spite of telling several news outlets that he had finished college. Can you tell us about that controversy?
Yeah, so Mandela Barnes had said when he was campaigning that he had finished college. In fact, he's short of completing college, which came out when the Business News Weekly in Madison profiled him. And that was disclosed. And so now there's a lot of looking back at his past statements. You know, recently he had tweeted pictures of himself, in cap and gown with the folder that holds a diploma, saying, "I can't believe it's 10 years since I finished college." A lot of scrutiny of that word "finish," because he went to college for a time. There was a point at which he was done with college, but he did not, in fact, graduate.
So he said it's a small technical thing, and he's working on getting apparently a telecommunications degree.
That's what he says. Yes.
We don't
have his transcript. We don't know how close he came to completing college. We just know he was there for certain years, and that he was not explicit about what actually happened in college. Now he says he's trying to complete it to wrap up an incomplete that he had.
Well, let's move on now to the lame duck laws. There's another lame duck lawsuit. Unlike the other four lawsuits over lame duck session laws, this one is being brought by Republicans. Can you help us understand what this latest challenge looks like?
Sure. So the early lawsuits were all brought by Democrats or groups aligned with Democrats to try to stop these lame duck laws from being implemented. These laws, of course, were passed after Evers and Josh Call won their elections in November, but before they took office, and they limit the powers of the governor and the attorney general. The latest lawsuit was brought by Republican legislative leaders, and they're sort of turning the tables and saying that Josh Call is supposed to follow the lame duck laws and is not doing so. And so they're asking the state Supreme Court to force him to involve lawmakers in more litigation. When the state is in lawsuits under the lame duck laws in certain scenarios, he needs to get permission from the Joint Finance Committee to settle or otherwise wrap up certain kinds of litigation. Now, Call says he is following the law. It's just that the lame duck laws apply in fewer instances than Republicans think. And we haven't really heard from the state Supreme Court yet whether they're going to hear this case or not. They've just asked for a briefing to decide whether to take this up with the many other lawsuits that are already pending.
We have heard, though, from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. They said in a statement, "It is egregious that Attorney General Call is playing a game of political keep away with potentially up to $20 million in funds that belong to hardworking Wisconsinites." Can you break down what they mean by that?
Sure. So part of the lame duck law says that when the state settles lawsuits, if it collects money from a party, it needs to deposit that money into the general fund. So that's the state's main bank account and one from which lawmakers direct how the money is spent. A lot of times in settlements, let's say a telephone company is found to have ripped off people, the money would be used in a way that would go toward consumer protection efforts. And so Josh Call is saying that much of this money is money that he can direct into Department of Justice programs, and the lawmakers say they need to be the ones to decide how that money gets spent.
And that's a lot of money that needs some type of direction, some type of pot of money to go toward. And it sounds like it's a bit of a tug of war there.
It's definitely a tug of war there. And that $21 million would be cases that have been settled or resolved since Call took office. Now, during much of that time, it's clear from past court orders that the lame duck laws were not in effect at that time. And so it's really unclear at this stage how much money would be in play. I think the big picture is what happens to money that flows into the state in the future.
So how else does this lawsuit differ from the previous lame duck cases that we've been seeing?
Well, in many ways, it's kind of an outgrowth of a lawsuit that unions brought against the lame duck laws. They've challenged many aspects of the laws on individual bases, saying that provisions of the lame duck laws take too much from the executive branch and give it to the legislative branch, violating the separation of powers doctrine. And one aspect of that is how lawsuits are settled, saying that the attorney general has the ability to direct how lawsuits are conducted. A lower court agreed with the unions. The state Supreme Court is now reviewing that case, and in the meantime has undone most of the lower court's ruling and so has put into effect that part of the lame duck law. Now the fight is over exactly what the lame duck law says on this point. And, you know, the language may be a little ambiguous. That's what the attorney general says. And he says the best interpretation is that it applies in very limited circumstances. He blames the lack of clarity on the fact that the legislation was put together very quickly between the time of him and Evers being elected and, you know, passed a month later by the legislature before they were sworn in.
We're moving through developments at the state capitol with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's politics and state house reporter Patrick Marley as our guide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of lame duck lawsuits involving voter ID and early voting laws, constitutional issues? Does it surprise you that these laws are still tied up in court? Also, do you think Wisconsin lawmakers should be doing more to change gun policy? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with more State Capitol Report here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, you're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're moving through the political issues, the bills in circulation, the back and forth among lawmakers at the State Capitol, and an eye on the courts, including the lame duck laws, the laws passed by Republican lawmakers in December related to issues like voter ID and early voting and constitutional issues. Should these laws passed be challenged in court? Also, the conservative think tank, the MacGyver Institute, filed a lawsuit against Governor Evers in federal court to force the governor to add the group to a media list. What do you make of that development? Join in at 800-642-1234. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel politics and state house reporter Patrick Marley is breaking it all down for us, and he stays with us. Patrick, let's look for a moment. You were talking about the Service Employees International Union, one of the lame duck lawsuits there, but also the League of Women Voters lawsuit. What do we know about that lawsuit alleging that extraordinary sessions are unconstitutional in the first place?
Summer, the state Supreme Court ruled that extraordinary sessions are allowed, ended that lawsuit in favor of the Republican lawmakers, and said that this process is something that the legislature gets full say as to when it comes into session, and so that the legislators properly brought themselves in December with, you know, it didn't matter that they didn't have much notice to the public. They're allowed to do that. They can come in whenever they want, which is a practice that they've been doing for a very long time. You know, this had never really been challenged in court, but had become accepted practice for a very long time. The court said that was fine. So now all of the litigation, and there's a lot of it, over the lame duck laws comes down to the substance of it. Do individual provisions violate the state constitution or the U.S. Constitution?
Some of that substance, though, involves early voting and voter ID. What do we know about that aspect of the lawsuit involving One Wisconsin Institute?
So that is one where the Democrats have had success. You know, many of the almost all the lame duck laws are in effect right now. And Republicans have really been on a winning streak with the litigation. But the early voting provision is something that Democrats prevailed on very quickly. And that's because years ago, the Democratic group, or democratically aligned group, One Wisconsin Institute, sued over a big group of voting laws and had large success in court that found one restriction on early voting was in violation of federal voting laws. And that restriction had put early voting to 2 weeks. Previously, local governments were able to decide on their own when to hold early voting. Republicans had made it to just the 2 weeks before an election. And so that was struck down. The lame duck laws tried to reinstate that with a slight variant on it. As soon as the lame duck laws were put into effect, One Wisconsin Institute went back to the same federal judge who had ruled in their favor before and said, this new law violates the is a mirror image basically of the previous law. It violates your court order. And the judge quickly agreed and said that the early voting limits were, or early voting was a decision for the local governments to decide. They couldn't put these restrictions that the state had of just 2 weeks of early voting.
So lots to watch there in the courts. But let's turn our attention now to what we're seeing in gun policy with the string of mass shootings in recent weeks. What we talked earlier with State Representative Melissa Sargent. How have state lawmakers responded? And is that echoing what we normally see nationally when we see a mass shooting?
Yeah, at the state level, you've seen a lot of Democrats saying that this is a reminder why they believe that we need universal background checks or red flag laws. So there's some other proposals floating out there that they've been talking about. Republicans who control both houses of the legislature have largely been silent on what they want to do. They've either said they think we have adequate gun laws or that these new gun laws that Democrats have proposed would not be effective and or inhibit Second Amendment rights, and they're not interested in it. But mostly they've been quiet about it. The Republican leaders are supposed to meet with Governor Evers this week to talk about some ideas he might have, though we don't know the specific plans they might be discussing. But really, there's been resistance from Speaker Robin Voss and Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald to any ideas so far. They've raised a lot of concerns about red flag laws, with Voss in particular saying that he's worried they would be put in place in a way that would infringe on the Second Amendment.
We're talking with Patrick Marley, who is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, moving through issues at the state capitol. Let's go on to MacIver Institute. Last week, the think tank, the MacIver Institute, filed a suit against Governor Evers in federal court to force the governor to add the MacIver Institute to a media list that gets advanced notice of press conferences. And let's hear two comments now back to back on this. The first voice is Daniel Sir, who is an attorney at the Liberty Justice Center. And then we'll hear from Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council President Bill Luders.
They have specifically targeted the MacIver Institute for exclusion from these otherwise generally available press events. And the First Amendment just doesn't let you do that.
The Evers administration doesn't have to answer MacIver Institute's questions if it doesn't want to. But the idea of barring its reporters from otherwise open press events is just ridiculous. What are they afraid of?
What are they afraid of? Patrick, what do you make of this media freedom lawsuit challenge?
It's an interesting case and, you know, maybe a challenge for Evers' administration. If nothing else, it's a PR challenge because he's being accused of not giving the press free access here to his events. So the MacIver Institute is a conservative think tank. They have a news operation for years. They've been covering proceedings of the legislature and events that the governor has. Didn't have a problem getting into Governor Walker's events. Democrats don't like their news operation because they, really are tilted to the Republican side of things, the conservative point of view. And so MacIver says that it's not able to get the routine press releases the governor's office puts out that tells reporters where he's going to be and when he's going to be there. at times they have, it's often an open secret as to when and where these events are. So MacGyver has turned up at them and hasn't been barred from them when it does, for the most part, and at times does ask questions. There was one briefing on the state budget as just before the state budget was released. MacGyver was attempted to attend and was kept from attending that. That is part of their lawsuit, and that may be the that will be a crucial part of their lawsuit, because there's really two issues here. One, they were kept from an event the governor had. And then two, they're saying they're just not being told about events, which is a limitation on their ability to find out what the governor thinks on issues.
Yeah, we'll be watching there. So as we wrap up, it may seem way too early to ask this question, but you're writing about what we're seeing when it comes to Republican candidates for 2022. What do we know there?
Yeah, and the reason we looked at that issue is because, for a time, former Governor Walker was talking about running for governor again in 2022 or running for Senate, and Ron Johnson is thinking about running for a third term in 2022 or running for governor. No one thought the two of them would run against each other, but we had the potential that, they would switch places, so to speak. So that really prevented any other candidate, and there are a lot of Republicans thinking about running for higher office, from being able to run. Now Scott Walker has said that he's taking a job with Young America's Future and that he won't be running for anything in 2022. So that caused us to take a look at what the field looks like. The big puzzle piece here remains Ron Johnson, who could seek a third term for Senate, run for governor, or do neither and open up the field. But there's a lot of other Republicans, from former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish to Waukesha County Executive Paul Farrow, who are thinking about running for governor, Senate, either, both.
Well, we'll be watching. Patrick, yeah. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, we explain a Trump administration proposal to import prescription drugs from Canada. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Ideas Network.